It's time for Branding Business, the only show that brings branding experts and corporate executives together to explore how branding your business can improve both your top-line growth and bottom-line performance. Brought to you by Rikus Baird. And now, here's your host.
Welcome to Branding Business with Rikus Baird. I'm Ryan Rikus, and today's show topic is focused on lessons learned from the author of a new business book, The Greatest Business Decisions of All Time. Today's guest is Vern Harnish. Vern is an author, consultant, and entrepreneur. He's the founder of world-renowned Entrepreneurs Organization, a global business network of more than 8,000 successful entrepreneurs. Vern is also the founder and CEO of Gazelles, a global executive education and coaching company where he spent the last 30 years educating entrepreneurial teams. And as an author, he currently writes for Fortune and has a syndicated column titled The Growth Guy. He's the author of two business books, Mastering the Rockefeller Habits, and most recently, The Greatest Business Decisions of All Time. Welcome, Vern.
Ryan, glad to be with you from Barcelona, Spain. Obviously one of the hot spots of the global economy right now, if you've read.
Yeah, absolutely. You're in the news often. Well, maybe that's a perfect way to start the discussion on this global or very broad-based level. You consult with businesses all over the globe, and are you seeing any type of consistent trends or themes or attitudes with business executives today?
You know, the growth companies that we work with, Ryan, they seem to be able to make money in good times and in bad times. You know, generally they see it as nothing but just, you know, clear sailing for the next decade. And I think one of the reasons is we've got this 1.4 billion people that are moving into the middle class between kind of 2011, last year, and 2020. And it's kind of like what the baby boom did for the United States. This kind of elephant moving through the global economic snake is going to raise all boats. And so our message, even back to them, and I think if they hear it enough, they're believing it, that if you can't make more money, not that that's the only mission but of your business, but if you can't make more money than you've ever seen in this next decade, I think it's, you know, the business person's fault. And so at least from the growth company perspective, we're seeing huge opportunities. And one of the reasons why we've been such fans of Peter Diamandis' book this year called Abundance, which I think lays out a good case and a counterpoint to all this negative news that we all read.
Well, it certainly feels that the Great Recession is behind us and that there is new opportunity emerging, especially in the U.S. And over the last few years, we've heard this term, cautious optimism. And maybe you're not feeling the same thing from your growth companies that you're consulting with, but how does the U.S. compare to the rest of the world? Is there, you know, can you speak a little bit more specifically around the growth opportunities in the U.S.?
Well, first of all, I mean, the sad news from the U.S. perspective, in a way, is that majority of that 1.4 billion are kind of slightly east of the U.S. You know, it's centered in India, it's down in Nigeria, obviously it's China, Indonesia, and those places. And so, you know, as you read, they're on fire. They're the real growth economies. And to me, Ryan, the number, the one metric that I think we're woefully behind on is exports per capita. You know, Germany is the leader in that. And by the way, they saw their employment. You know, if we just look at the two economies, I think Germany and the United States are, you know, kind of similar in makeup and GDP per capita and those kind of things. Germany, which has been, you know, stuck in this mess called Europe, they saw their unemployment drop from 7.5% January 2009 to 5.5%. It's been a steady downhill. Where the U.S., we were at 7.8%. It went as high as 10% and just now is back to 7.8. We've had a disaster. And we're really the same economies. And the fundamental difference are twofold. The Germans aren't so obsessed with saving just large companies like we are in the United States. They made the decision, Merkel made the decision, to support all companies through the recession and supported them in keeping their employees. In the United States, we bailed out one large company and basically paid people not to work. And I think, you know, there's the results. The other, though, is exports. And I think this goal of us doubling exports is exactly what we need to focus on. Folks might not realize, but the Germans per capita export four times as much than we do in the United States. And we should be export kings and queens. Even Spain, Ryan, exports twice as much per capita than the United States. So the place that we're mission in action is truly doing global business. And when I took my family around the world for a year, I literally met no American kind of entrepreneur business people. I met plenty of Dutch, plenty of Brits, plenty of Germans, plenty of everybody, but folks from our own country. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that, but those are the realities that I'm seeing. So we need to up our game in just doing global business.
Well, I think it begins with actually creating products that people want. How long is it going to take for America to turn this around?
Well, it's interesting. We're getting ready to hire a host next week, the Dartmouth professor, Vijay Govindarajan, who wrote a book called Reverse Innovation. And I think it's one of the more important books that was released here in 2012. And he really talks about how the next wave of companies are those that are actually designing on purpose products for the third world, for the growth economies, and bringing them back to the first world economies instead of reverse. So, for instance, GE, forced by the Indian economy, created a very inexpensive set of medical devices because they can't afford anything more than that in India, and they're now bringing those devices back to the United States. So I think the big issue is we've just been stuck because we had the opportunity to have such a large economy, and we're able to do so well locally, that we just had no reason to get out of town. And as a result, we've fallen woefully behind the rest of the globe. The other big thing is a simple tax policy. And I had asked some British entrepreneurs that I had met in Abu Dhabi, finally, why aren't I seeing any Americans? And he said, Vern, you don't get it. And I said, obviously I don't. He said, U.S. is one of only two countries. The other one, name I can't even pronounce and didn't even know it existed. It's only two countries in the world that tax its expats. No other country, no industrialized country, any other country does that. And so we're at immediate major disadvantage out there in the global economy because of this one unique tax that's different than any other country.
Well, Vern, I think you hit on something there in the sense that you mentioned sometimes you have to, change is hard. Sometimes you don't realize the need for change until times get tough. And I think that's one of the themes that I pulled out of your book. And so maybe we can transition our discussion to your book because I think there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from it. So The Greatest Business Decisions of All Time, you together with these authors from Fortune provide an inside perspective of I think around 17 companies and the leaders who made these really big decisions at the time. And so the theme of overcoming adversity, dealing with change that really can shape the company in the future, had just this, I think, just incredible knowledge and guidance that we can all learn from these decisions. Maybe can you give us a few different examples of some of the decisions, some of the executives, some of the teams that you found most impactful?
Yeah, and it was a fun book to put together, I think, just for historical purposes, Ryan. I mean, there wasn't one single place where you could kind of go to a resource and get the inside story on, because a lot of folks are familiar with the decision, but it was how the decision got made that not only changed the company, but, you know, we chose most of them because they also changed industries and in the case of a few of them, two of my favorite five, literally changed nations. And so let me kind of walk through at least my top five. By the way, we didn't put them in any order in the book, though we did choose number one and made it the last chapter of the book. But I have my own personal five favorites, so I'll just kind of walk through them. You know, the number five I put was Jack Welch. And by the way, he's been massively in the news this last couple of weeks. Was his tough decision why he was laying 100,000 people to go, which is kind of what he got in trouble for in the media this last 2 weeks. But he had to make that tough decision back in the early 80s. And at the same time, made an investment of $50 million into Crotonville, their executive education center. And up to that point, you know, corporate universities were kind of a nice HR thing to have, but it really wasn't a strategic weapon. And one of my favorite inside stories in the chapter is, as he was trying to justify this $50 million investment, I'm telling you, the board and its executives and everybody were just beating him up for this decision. He kind of asked the guy who was running Crotonville, this Harvard prof, to do an ROI calculation for him. And so the guy put together these calculations, and they had the big meeting, and Jack sitting in there looking through all the calculations and kind of thinking about them. And I think in one of those just great, bold, gutsy leadership moves, he crosses out the ROI calculation, and he simply writes the word infinite. And he said, that's really the return on investing in the people we've got. And that's going to serve us the best. And by the way, the rest is history. You know, GE is still today known as probably the top training ground for executives, and many of whom have gone out now and run other major companies. So to me, the lesson is the unbelievable importance of investing in the folks that we have within our own companies, and I think it's obviously something we've got to really up our game at in general in the United States, and that to try to do any kind of ROI calculation is just crazy. You know, if you hang in very poor countries, you know, there they don't question at all. Here we're witnessing in the news a young girl who, you know, has taken a bullet in the head for standing up and saying, look, we value education that much and think it's that important. I think we lose sight of that in our wealthier countries. Number four, to me, I think was one of the craziest and probably most unknown stories, and that was of a decision made in 1990 by the leader of Samsung. And a lot of people don't realize, but Samsung is the seventh largest company in the world, $250 billion in revenue. It's one of the only firms that could really take on Apple right now, which is why Apple's been so aggressive with them around these patents. And what allowed this little dinky company, you know, in this small country, South Korea, to become such a global force? And it was this decision during a time when they were very isolated. You know, the culture was only learn Korean. And the chairman said, look, we're going to take several hundred young people, kind of our hotshot young stars, and we're going to spend $100,000 per, plus their wages, and we're going to drop them off in some corner of the planet for a year and basically let them just kind of goof off. And what that really meant is you're not going to be doing any real work. You're going to go learn the language. You're going to go learn the culture. You're going to go learn about the leadership. And you're going to figure out and build kind of a bridge between South Korea and that country that we think over the next several decades will serve us well. And in there, my favorite story is of the Korean they sent to Russia. And when he came back, he submitted this 80-page report. And the chairman loved it because he didn't mention once business, but he went on and on about the drinking habits of the Russians and the like. And sure enough, that young man ended up leading Samsung in Russia to become the number one brand in their space. And by the way, the Netherlands, what I think is one of the great countries from doing global business, they have a similar initiative where they loan out top retired executives to whole countries like Gambia to kind of help them build roads and the whole like. And what it also does is build these huge bridges between the Dutch and everybody else, which is one of the reasons why you see Dutch everywhere in the economy, in the global economy. So I loved that example of Samsung, and I think it's the same kind of initiative that the companies in the United States ought to embark on. Number three was Walmart. critical decision that Sam Walton made literally in his first store. Because the question is, how do you really build what's the largest revenue company in the world? They're approaching $500 billion in revenue. It's just, you know, insane. And the ability to be able to maintain that kind of lead over four decades resulted in just this one decision. And it was to hold a meeting on Saturday morning. Sam was felt bad that as the owner of the store that he wasn't necessarily going to have to work weekends, and weekends are the really busy time for a store. So he wanted to indicate to his employees that were working that he was there engaged. And so he started this Saturday morning meeting. He'd gather them together, and the real question is, hey, what did we learn from customers this week? What did you see? And by the way, this is way before, you know, owners typically thought that their employees had anything to contribute, let alone be listened to. And then they would decide, and Sam would also be shopping competitors during the week, and they would decide every Saturday morning, Ryan, one or two things they could do to make that store just a little better, kind of 1% improvement every week, compound interest is your friend. Well, let's skip forward several decades later. 200 leaders at Walmart basically head out Monday through Thursday, talking to customers, talking to employees, shopping competitors. They get back to Bentonville for this series of kind of, you know, critical meetings on Friday. And by Saturday morning, they make decisions of changes that ought to be made by noon, you know, end cap by end cap, aisle by aisle. So that our analysis, at least at Fortune, is this one habit, this one routine, has allowed them to remain about 9 days ahead of the competition for decades. And so I think it speaks a lot to the need, and I think it goes back to this lean startup that Eric Ries has made popular, that we can't be making business decisions in isolation in our ivory tower, but we ought to be spending, I think literally, our message is 80% of your work week, if you're a leader of a company, out in the field with customers, employees, and shopping competitors. Number two, by the way, and it's the reason I wrote the book, was Apple bringing back Steve Jobs. It was actually on the anniversary of Steve's death that my book was essentially released, because it was a year before, when he had just passed away, that I was with our partner in India kind of lamenting both the loss of Steve and what an incredible decision it had to have been that somehow or another Apple brought back the founder. I mean, never in history had a founder left, been fired basically, gone for 10 years, and then ends up back doing the greatest work of his life, to quote, you know, Steve himself, and resulting in the most valuable company on the planet 2 months before he passed away. And so I was just, you know, amazed by what was the inside story of that decision. And I think the lesson is that I think we shed founders way too soon in companies that VCs and others have invested. In fact, I think the reason Andreessen and Horowitz's VC firm, they're the ones that did the big Skype deal and made several billion, and several others that have just been probably the hottest deals in Silicon Valley in the last 24 months, I think the reason they're hot is they have a kind of counter position that the founder should stay and should be taught how to run a company, as opposed to gotten out of the way sooner than later. And in fact, Herman Simon's research into the hidden champions, these countries that have powered Germany, and lessons we could learn more in the United States, he found the average tenure of founders at these hidden champion companies was 20 years. By the way, the story I love in the book about this decision, it, little known, we had to dig into to find this out, but it was a guy named Garrett Rice at Next who, unbeknownst to Steve, because Steve really was busy with Pixar, had independently gone to Apple and asked them if they'd be interested in purchasing Next. And that's what got the conversation started. Again, also unknown to the board at Apple. So this was something that happened at the mid-level of both companies that then obviously led to Steve making it back. the number one decision, and it is the one that we named as number one, I think very applicable today, as it was almost 100 years ago, was in 1914, Henry Ford, overnight doubling wages from $2.50 a day to $5 a day. By the way, not unlike what we're seeing here in China, the same thing Foxconn has had to do in order to kind of quell the rioting that's been going on in Apple's various facilities and manufacturing facilities. And what I love about the decision is it really was the first time, Ryan, that a company saw labor more than just economic input that needed to be minimized. That it literally was a resource that deserved to be invested in and was the actual market for their own product. And that by doubling the wages, first he put them way out front of GM and all the other competitors in terms of being able to get literally the best talent and the most talent. Thousands of folks flocked to Ford and seeking jobs. But it really raised the entire standard of living in the United States. I think it's the one decision that ultimately led to making the United States the most viable country in the world, which it still is today. And it's those kind of, I think, bold decisions, like the one that Samsung made and others, that I think we need more of here today. So that's kind of my top five.
Fantastic, compelling stories, and I got a lot out of the other dozen or so out there as well. So I guess the other theme that really emerged for me as I read the book was this idea around culture, and that the leader of the organization or leaders establish the culture at the top that then permeates throughout the entire company. And that, of course, can become such a powerful driving force behind any business. And certainly the leaders set the culture, but then it's difficult to create a culture, but it's more difficult to actually maintain it. Can you give us a few thoughts just on your viewpoint about maintaining the right culture of an organization?
Well, you know, a couple of thoughts. You and I were talking about Jim Collins' Ford to the book. And, you know, my view is worth the price of the book alone. And, you know, in that Ford, he talks about how the most important decision business people make is the who decision. And that's very much what culture is about, is really how do we impact, how do we attract, how do we retain the right people, the right who's in the business. And our view, and it really comes probably more from my first book, Ryan, on how to do that, because we don't really get into the how-to, as you know. It's more the biographical and historical stories. But the real how-to goes back to Crotonville and one of the things that we teach companies, which is you've got to get the culture is really carried by the supervisors and middle managers. Not so much the front line, not so much the senior executive team, but it's the middle management that are the real carriers and maintainers of that culture. And the key is you've got to get them together once a month in a room for a day. And by working on real problems together with the senior leadership team, you get this DNA transfer. And that was the key thing they did at Crotonville. Jack Welch, first dates he put in his calendar 15 months in advance with his assistant, Roseanne Badowski, was the day he and each of the leaders of GE needed to go to Crotonville and spend with the up-and-coming middle managers. And they didn't just go there. They went to teach and to listen and to learn in kind of together with these up-and-comers. And that's when the real DNA transfer occurs. We're doing something similar with a company called Ashana Housing in New Delhi. They don't really have a culture of developing mid-management over there. And we've got the three brothers, the Gupta brothers, who are trying to run this, you know, public company on their own backs. Finally get in the room once a month with the 70 middle managers that are between them and the other 450 employees. And the results after 2 years have been phenomenal. in terms of those 70, then passing on the cultural, you know, cues to the other, you know, almost 500, then those passing them down to the 2,500 contractors. And it's why they've been named one of the top 200 best companies in all of Asia under $1 billion. And so it's getting a room once a month, working on real problems together, and causing that DNA transfer to occur.
Well,
and by the way, I think it's the reason
Collins,
why Steve Jobs spent the last 2 years of his life, Ryan, focused on building Apple University, in a way revisiting what Jack Welch did at GE.
Well, it goes back to that internal training and the culture of overcoming adversity and bringing the group together to really be a very, very powerful team. And, you know, in addition to Collins' viewpoint on who, in other words, getting the right people on the bus, right, I also took away something from his readings of the past was the idea of why. Why do we exist as an organization? And basically, we do a lot of work with companies, of course, developing their brand strategy. And I actually became very frustrated when I would sit down with executives and ask them, okay, if we're going to build your brand, it's helpful to know what your vision is. And I would rarely get a very clear answer as to what is the true corporate vision. And so this led us to do a lot of research on our own. We actually went out and researched a couple hundred CEOs, tried to get a better understanding of how they view vision or mission or positioning or purpose, and just became very clear that there was just not a consistent understanding or agreement on what these statements stood for or how they're used. So we actually built our own model, and at the center, it's purpose, why we exist, that emotional connection that really unites and binds the entire organization to solve something bigger than just a financial metric. And then outside
That's
vision.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. And when we do this with executives, when we work on their purpose statements and their vision statements, what they aim to achieve and mission, how we're going to achieve it, usually the purpose statement is the one that they get emotionally behind. And then that becomes kind of the mantra that they build upon and really try to teach throughout the organization. So we found it to become very, very powerful and a driver of culture and a rebirth of actually utilizing statements like vision and mission, which some people can, you know, perceive them as passé, and, you know, you check the box and get it done, but that just doesn't work. It never is effective. But if you can get people really aligned around where you're going as an organization and their role to get there, now you can create a pretty powerful culture. So anyway,
and you're right, the 18 that we feature, you know, every one of those companies, whether it's GE's, who literally are serious about we bring good things to life, to, you know, Steve Jobs. You know, he just wanted to create a bicycle for the mind. And it was the passion and purpose behind all the years that he toiled there at Apple. You're right, these companies have that powerful purpose in common among all their people.
Well, it's when we work with clients, it's a combination of really aligning their business strategy and their brand strategy together to be, you know, really known for one thing. And if you can become known for one thing, then it becomes much easier to communicate that vision and really then align people around that. And I like, for example, how you branded the growth guy. It's a pretty clear promise in your coaching and your column, and it's, you know, very succinct. And just question, how do you go about aligning executives under one common direction when you go through the process of coaching these executive teams?
Well, that's one of the key reasons why we created this one-page strategic plan, because, you know, I'm sure you hear the same thing. You know, execs say, if I could just get everybody on the same page, you know, and the problem is you got to have the page first for everybody to get on. And so we thought we'd take the best practices from Jim Collins and Gary Hamel and Stephen Covey and not make up stuff, but see if we could integrate the best practices of core values and purpose and brand, you know, positioning and the like into one document that kind of takes them from core values to quarterly theme. And that's been the thing we've probably been best known for all over the world. In fact, it was exciting. We got literally got an email today from an owner of one of the major NFL franchises. I said, "Hey, Vern, just got your book, and we're leading a big quarterly off or annual offsite here for 2013, and we're going to be using the one-page strategic plan to kind of drive what our sports organization is going to do over the next 12 months." And so that's how we've done it, is through this kind of Rockefeller habits process that I outlined in the first book.
Well, I read that as well, and I've used your process for our own company. So I'd like to endorse it for those listeners out there.
Well, much appreciated. I know you've been a great student of business, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Well, that's the great thing of what we do. We get an opportunity to work with such a wide variety of businesses and apply the best practices from one to another, and to utilize examples that you've covered in this book to really help drive business forward. And
by the way, to support what you're saying, because of this $1.4 billion moving into the middle class, really effectively almost doubling the market space for our products and services, this is absolutely why brand and the work you guys are doing is probably the most critical work this next decade. Keep doing what you guys are doing.
Well, I appreciate that. What we find that when a client has this viewpoint, they're most successful. When they view branding as a marketing function, it will not be successful. But if the CEO views branding as a corporate discipline, and that the CEO actually owns the responsibility of developing and protecting the brand, they are significantly more successful than just an organization that views branding as a marketing function, and that, you know, it's just branding, all that's just the marketing people doing that. It just will not be effective unless the CEO grabs it.
You bet.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I do have just one final question for you, and it's completely different than the topic we've been on, but I think our listeners could benefit from you, and that is the area of social media. You have been an advocate and very effective in using social media to build your brand. And yet so many companies out there still ask the question, especially in the B2B world, how can I use social media? Can you just give us a quick overview of that?
Well, and maybe this answer might be a little bit different, but I'm enamored by Facebook, the company. You know, here they've done in 8 years what it's taken other companies 80 years to achieve. It's, you know, it's the youngest self-made billionaire in history, Mark Zuckerberg. And the real lesson we can learn from Facebook is that last century, it was about getting the right butts on the right seats, as Jim Collins said, and that still applies today. But in addition, it's who gets the most butts on the bus, who gets the most people to help you out. And that's really Facebook and Google and Amazon and Wikipedia's key to their success. They built business models where, in essence, there's 1 billion volunteers helping make Zuckerberg rich. There's 7 million volunteers keeping Wikipedia up to date in any one moment. And so I think the lesson and one of the real uses of social media is how do you solicit, you know, 1 million people to help you in your own business? And when you take it from that perspective, as opposed to just another distribution channel for our products and services, then I think you're going to really be able to power your business moving forward.
Well, especially in this global economy that we opened the segment with, right?
You bet.
All right, Vern. Well, I think we're out of time, unfortunately. I think we could continue talking for another hour, but I really appreciate your time today, and thank you for being a guest on Branding Business. Do you have any final thoughts or insights to share with our listeners today?
No, I think it's what we talked about. Brand is everything, especially in this next decade when these billion four are also going to be competitors. So not only do we have more customers, but we have more competition that can reach, you know, across the globe into our own backyard. And so evermore, you'd better be on point with your branding strategy.
Absolutely. And brand can clarify that point precisely and become well-known for one thing and attract that particular audience. Not trying to be everything to everybody, right?
You got it, Ryan.
Well, if our listeners have any questions of you, how could they reach you? Go to your website or...
you bet, yeah. Head to gazelles.com, G-A-Z-E-L-L-E-S.com. about 80 free articles, my Growth Guy columns up there, access to Fortune columns, and all of our tools are free as well, including the one-page plan. So hopefully they'll find those useful.
Well, Vern, thanks again. Really appreciate your time.
You bet.
That concludes our show for today. This is Ryan Rikus, and you've been listening to another edition of Brand New Business with Rikus Baird. If you'd like to listen to the past shows or read our blog series, visit brandnewbusiness.com. And until our next show, stay focused.
You've been listening to Branding Business, the only show that brings branding experts and corporate executives together to explore how branding your business can improve both your top-line growth and bottom-line performance. To hear more, simply visit our website, brandingbusiness.com, or tune in next week to learn how you too can build your brand and move your business forward. Brought to you by Rikus Baird.